The time is 3:30. I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 30th, and as I said, the time is 3:30. With the committee today are committee members, Vice Chair Senator Dyson, Senator Fairclough, Senator Bishop, Senator Machicki, Senator French, and myself, Senator Geisel, the chair. We will have a delayed arrival. I expect Senator McGuire will be joining us shortly. And I don't see any other elected members of the legislature in the audience. So today we are having an overview of the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Environmental Conservation. So we'll start with the Department of Fish and Game. So I'll invite Commissioner Cora Campbell to step forward. This is a 90-minute meeting. And so what I'm going to do is kind of set a timer for about 35 minutes. That will allow about 10 minutes afterward for some follow-up questions and whatnot, if that's okay with you, Commissioner.
Absolutely.
All right, great. Just kind of helps us stay on task and leave enough time for the second presentation. So welcome. And whenever you're ready, I'll let you go ahead and begin.
Thank you. For the record, Cora Campbell, Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game, and behind me in the audience is Deputy Commissioner Kevin Brooks and Ben Mulligan, our legislative liaison. We have a presentation for you today that just gives you a high-level overview of our department. I included in the slides our mission statement so that you can see that, and then the next slide shows the sections of the Constitution and the Alaska statutes that our mission statement is derived directly from. We have six core services as a department, and they're listed for you on this slide. The first is harvest management, and we measure our success at this core service by looking at things like the commercial harvest and the purchases of hunting and fishing licenses, how many angler days are spent out on the water, and the success that users have. The second is stock assessment, and this we measure our success at this by looking at how frequently we meet escapement goals for salmon, how often we conduct wildlife surveys, those types of metrics. Customer service is an important core service for us, and we enact this one primarily through having angling skills programs, hunter heritage and education, informing people about wildlife and wildlife management, and just generally providing information to all of our constituents. Yeah, and the fourth is public involvement, and this is primarily ensuring that the public has the information and the ability to participate in the regulatory processes through the Board of Fish and the Board of Game, but also making sure that the public has the ability to weigh in on decisions that are made by the department. So we conduct a lot of outreach in an attempt to meet this core service. The fifth is state sovereignty. This is something that we participate in federal land management planning exercises. We have a lot of effort that goes into Endangered Species Act work. We support the Department of Law when they have a challenge in one of those areas. Spend time in the Federal Subsistence Board process, just generally spend time and energy on attempting to protect the state's authority to manage fish and wildlife. And the sixth is habitat protection. And this is measured primarily through whether developers are in compliance with the permits that are issued by Habitat Division. And we also have some measures and metrics to ensure that permitting is happening in a consistent and timely manner. I've included this just as an overview of where we're located throughout the state. You can see that we have regional and area offices in many communities. That's part of how the department is designed. To be fairly broadly distributed, to have biologists on the ground in the field near the resources and near the users. This includes our permanent offices. It doesn't include the many places where we have a seasonal camp, where we're running a weir or a sonar. Those aren't included, so these are just our permanent facilities. I'll just run through quickly with you the different divisions that we have and what those divisions are responsible for. We have three large divisions that we call management divisions, and those are commercial fisheries, sport fisheries, and wildlife conservation, and then several smaller divisions. So starting off with commercial fisheries, which is our largest division, They're responsible, as you would expect, for management of commercial fisheries and research related to those resources, but they're also responsible for management of many personal use and subsistence fisheries in state waters. We manage some species and resources from 3 to 200 miles under agreements with the federal government. And this division is also responsible for permitting any aquaculture or mariculture operation in the state. Sport fish is another one of our large divisions responsible for management of sport fisheries and research related to those resources. They also have responsibilities for promoting boater access, angler access, and programs designed to preserve access opportunities for anglers. Division of Wildlife Conservation, responsible, as you would expect, for management of wildlife, management of hunting, scientific surveys on wildlife. This division also operates three shooting ranges throughout the state and has a number of hunter ed programs and partnerships that are aimed at getting children outdoors, teaching them gun safety, those types of skills. Subsistence division is one of our smaller divisions, and this division is primarily responsible for research gathering information about customary and traditional use of Alaska's fish and wildlife. So subsistence division is not a management division. They're not responsible for managing subsistence hunts or subsistence fisheries. They're primarily a research division, and their primary responsibility is to provide that information about customary and traditional use to the Board of Fish or the Board of Game so that it can be used in that decision-making process. Habitat division is another one of our small divisions with an important responsibility for permitting activities that take place on anadromous water bodies or in fish-bearing waters, and also permitting anything that could have an impact on fish and wildlife that takes place in one of our special areas. There are 32 of those around the state, and they're things like critical habitat areas, wildlife refuges, those types of areas. So habitat does some permitting there, and then also responsible for monitoring in the field compliance with the permits that they issue. We have an administrative services division that does the things that you would expect an administrative services division to do: budget, HR, those types of management responsibilities. And then we have one section, the board support section, and this is a very small part of our department, but they perform an important function. It's all the logistical support for the regulatory meetings, so the Board of Fish meetings, the Board of Game meetings, the advisory committee meetings of the 80-some advisory committees that we have around the state. This section supports all of those activities and assists the public in understanding what's happening in those regulatory forums. We also have two agencies that are independent but are attached to Fish and Game for administrative purposes, and those are the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, which runs the limited entry programs into commercial fisheries, and the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, which is made up of three state and three federal trustees, and essentially is responsible for administering some of the research and restoration funding that came about as a result of the oil spill. And the Commissioner of Fish and Game is one of those state trustees.
Yes, Senator Dyson had a question.
Actually, a comment. I was in the Gulf shortly after the blowout of the platform and so on. And quite a number of scientists were there. And sadly, the word was, they didn't learn much from the Exxon Valdez. The same mistakes on containment and reclamation and so on were being made. But that's all a preamble for saying one of the wisest things that has been done with oil spills is what was done with the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Council. And he said there in the Gulf, they could not reasonably evaluate the impact because they didn't know what the pre-accident baseline was. And that's what one of the things the council is doing, is really getting a baseline, what the water quality is and the habitat and the biological stock there. So I had never thought about that, but I was pleased that we were doing something right. And and I know it's not your doing, but you all's support for it and all that is apparently very worthwhile.
Thank you, Senator. I've included a couple slides to show our some information on our positions. We have about 933 full-time staff, but you'll notice that we have more than 1,700 total positions. So we have a large number of seasonal and part-time positions, and that's reflective of the nature of our field season and the work that our staff do, and the fact that a lot of that work doesn't necessarily take place on a year-round basis. So that's why you see that pattern. You'll also notice here that, as I mentioned before, that whether you're looking at full-time positions or total positions, three of our divisions are very large and make up the bulk of the staffing in our agency, and then the smaller divisions account for a smaller proportion. There's some information here just on an overview level of our budget, both by division and by funding source. You'll again see that the three management divisions account for a large portion of the budget, and that our three largest funding sources are general fund, federal funds, and the Fish and Game Fund.
Senator Michicki.
Just a question for you, Commissioner. How many test fisheries exist in the state that comprise the revenue for that $19 million? Is that an easy question to answer?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, perhaps for some people, but I don't have the answer right off the top of my head as to the exact number, but we do have a number of test fisheries throughout the state, and I think that what the department has at least tried to do in recent years is focus on test fisheries that serve a scientific purpose. So fisheries where we're gathering information that's relevant to the management of the fishery, as opposed to, I guess, what I would refer to, they're sometimes called test fisheries, but what I would refer to as revenue fishing, where the department is really harvesting fish to support management activities, but the fish that are harvested don't provide direct scientific information to us for management.
Okay.
But we can get you a total number and where those fisheries are located and what percentage of that amount they account for generally on an annual basis.
Helpful, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about some of the things that the department has accomplished recently, and many of these accomplishments were made possible by support from the legislature for various funding initiatives and such that the department has brought forth, so I thought it would be good to update you on some of these. The first that I've called out here are some recent accomplishments in our salmon research programs. Probably the most notable of those is the completion of the Western Alaska Salmon Stock ID program. That was the largest of its kind to date, multi-year effort to better understand the genetic makeup of salmon that were harvested in Western Alaska fisheries. And that work, which involved a lot of consultation with stakeholders and a lot of work by our genetics lab, has been completed and has produced 9 reports that are now being used in the current Board of Fish cycle to help inform the management decisions that the board is making about those fisheries.
Did you have a question?
Mm-hmm, I do. Commissioner, thanks for coming today. Do you feel that your ID program is working as advertised, and you have enough staff and resources in your program to accurately, in a timely fashion, bring the information forward?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the Western Alaska Salmon Stock ID program specifically had a number of goals, and many of those goals were met upon completion of the program. The one that I would call out that was not is that I think that users were hoping for better differentiation of chum salmon up and down the Western Alaska coast. So they would like to be able to specify when a chum is harvested. Was that chum headed for a Bristol Bay drainage versus Yukon, Kuskokwim, or one of the Norton Sound rivers? And that that level of detail isn't currently possible as a result of this project, and so it's something that we'll continue to work towards in future iterations. Another thing that I would note is that when we get a little further in the presentation, we'll talk about the Chinook Salmon Research Initiative. There is some funding that we're requesting as part of that initiative for genetics work specifically. And for king salmon, there is again the need to be able to improve the baseline. And when we're talking about the baseline, we're talking about our understanding of genetic differences between different river systems, so that when we analyze a fish that's caught, we can attribute it to the river of origin. So that there's a couple of places where we're looking to make some improvements. But in general, I would say that the genetics lab is doing a good job of analyzing the samples that they have and getting the information out to inform decision makers.
Thank you.
I also wanted to just talk a little bit about some of our intensive management programs. That's an effort that the department has been undertaking for several years, and that effort is starting to bear fruit in a number of areas in the form of increased wildlife populations and increased harvest opportunities for Alaskans, which is really the goal. We have a couple of very compelling success stories in the South Alaska Peninsula herd. We have some increased moose populations in Game Management Unit 20, which is in interior Alaska. And so as a result of these programs, we're able to offer increased harvest opportunities, and we've seen successes there, and we have some other programs that we're modifying, where we're learning more about the impact of various predators on those populations so that we can make those programs more targeted and more successful. I would mention the work that we've been doing on subsistence harvest surveys. One of the things that we identified a couple years ago as a real challenge for the department is that subsistence division, which we talked about earlier, in many cases was dealing with data for communities that was decades old the last time they had been out to do comprehensive community work to see what kind of harvest patterns were there was in many cases 25 or more years ago. And so one of the things that we focused on with subsistence division is having the division coordinate with DNR or DOT so that if a road or a large development project is proposed, one of the things that's required now in those permitting processes is up-to-date subsistence information so that the impacts on subsistence harvesters can be understood. And so by having Subsistence Division do this work, it has the dual benefit of enabling the decision-making process for whatever permits might be required on those projects to go faster and to have the information that it needs, but also for us to update our own databases for use by the Board of Fish and the Board of Game when they're making determinations about the amount necessary for subsistence or those types of things. And so as a result of that, the division has been able to update their surveys for a number of communities that were badly out of date, and that's something that we hope to do more of in the future. We also requested some funding last year for our habitat division to be more involved early on in the pre-permitting project design type phase for some of the larger projects that we're seeing, and just to really be able to keep up with the demand in that division for timely permitting. And that's something that they've been able to do quite well at. They've been able to increase their involvement, and they've been able to keep their permitting turnaround days within the targets that we've set for them. So we're fairly pleased with how that's going. You know that the governor has had quite a focus on permit efficiency, and so we took a look at our divisions as well as a part of that initiative, and this is something that we feel is going well. And lastly, I would just note that our two sport fish hatcheries in Anchorage and Fairbanks are up and running. They're producing fish, and we're stocking those fish into lakes and rivers and providing fishing opportunity. We're back to the stocking levels that we were at before we lost the ability to use the waste heat from the Elmendorf. And the quality of the smolt that we're getting is very good. They're growing fast, and they're healthy when they're being released, so we're happy with how that's going. Um, But of course, the presentation would not be complete without talking about some of the challenges that we're facing. And the first one on the list is one that I'm sure all of you are familiar with. The Chinook salmon abundance and productivity is in a period of decline throughout the state, more severe in some regions than others, but clearly a statewide trend that we're seeing. And the need to ensure Chinook salmon escapement this summer led to a number of restrictions on fisheries that had tremendous impacts on Alaskans. And I think it was really illustrated quite clearly this summer the extent to which Alaskans rely on healthy Chinook salmon, whether it's for subsistence or commercial fishing or sport fishing or personal use. Really all user groups were impacted by the low productivity that we saw. In response to that, the department has developed what I mentioned earlier, which is the Comprehensive Chinook Salmon Research Plan, in order to shore up our understanding of the causes for this period of low abundance and what could be contributing to the decline. And so that plan has identified 12 stocks throughout the state that we consider to be good fits for indicator stocks, so to give us an indication of what's happening in that region, and then proposes projects to increase our understanding of the trends in adult harvest escapement, smolt out migration, some additional coated wire tagging work so that we can understand better where those fish go and are harvested in the marine environment, some genetics work, and some increased biometrics. And overall, the goal of the plan is to be able to understand the driving factors in the decrease in Chinook salmon productivity, to be able to better forecast the length of time we may be in a period of low abundance or what we can expect to see for returns on an annual basis, so that we can better target providing fishing opportunity where it's available, where we can better plan for the need to provide opportunity on other species while protecting Chinook salmon, and make modifications in order to do that, and to help users who rely on Chinook salmon to be able to plan accordingly. So I've noted here also that one of the things that we've been looking at, and one of the things that's a challenge for us, is that one of our real goals is to provide increased fishing and economic opportunities. And so we had a couple of initiatives last year, both governors and legislative initiatives, that were targeted in places where we felt that a better stock assessment by the department, a better understanding of what was happening with a stock, would allow us to provide increased fishing opportunity on that stock. And so demersal shelf rockfish in southeast Alaska is a good example. We have a project in the water this year to really do a better, more complete stock assessment on those fish, and that will allow us to provide as much opportunity as possible for fishing. It's a species where you have to be cautious because they're long-lived and they're not especially, you know, fast reproducers, and so we need to make sure that we have a complete picture, but once we get it, it could really benefit both commercial and sport fishing. So those are the types of things that we've been looking at across the state. A place where a small investment by the state in an increased level of understanding about a stock could really lead to a big payoff for Alaskans in terms of either sport fishing opportunity or commercial fishing opportunity and economic benefit in either case. So that's related to one of the challenges that I've called out next, which is reductions in our salmon management tools. The department over the years has absorbed a number of cost increases, whether it's related to inflationary pressures or negotiated salary increases, but the result of that is that we have less funds available for projects in the water. So if we had a weir that we were running for 2 months, we might only run it for 6 weeks and not get as good a sense of what's happening on the shoulders of the season. And so one of the things that we looked at when putting together our budget request for FY14 is places where, again, where we feel like investing in bringing those salmon management tools back up to past levels would increase our understanding in a way that would allow us to provide additional opportunity and additional benefit.
Commissioner, could I just stop you there for a minute? I have the Kenai River, one side of it anyway. Senator Michiki has the other side of it. And, of course, that was quite a hot spot, let's say, this last summer. And there was a tremendous amount of controversy about the counting device. Apparently, you had changed to a new counting technology. And there was question as to whether these two, the previous one and the present one this year, were actually collecting the same data. What would you say to that? What is the counting? How are you managing the counting of the escapement?
Senator Buesel, you are correct that counting the escapement on the Kenai has been a challenge. The department discovered that the old sonar that was being used was not providing an accurate picture of king salmon escapement. And the primary reason for that is because if you look at the fish numbers that are entering that river, kings at times can really be overwhelmed by the number of sockeyes that are entering the river. And the old sonar was misidentifying sockeyes as king salmon and inflating the number for the king salmon escapement. And that pattern had, for some reason, gotten more severe in recent years. So the old sonar was very far off what we considered reality to be. So in response to that, we deployed a Didson sonar, and it's a different type of sonar technology that allows us to better differentiate between king salmon and sockeye. And if you look at the readout for a Didson, it's not just sort of counting blips like the old sonar. It's really almost video quality. I mean, you can see the fish moving as it swims up the river. So it's a big improvement in that way. But the escapement goal, so the target number that we were shooting for, was still indexed to the old system. And so that really caused some controversy this year, having an escapement goal that was in a unit of measure that we are no longer able to count in. So in response, the department developed a new escapement goal that is based on and measured by the Didson sonar. And it sounds like a simple thing to have your escapement target and your measuring tool be in the same unit of measure, but we have not had that on the Kenai for several years. And when there is as much at stake as there is in those Cook Inlet fisheries, it is very difficult for users when you cannot clearly point them to a single number and relate that to your management target. And so we really think that the 2013 season is going to be a big improvement to have that management target clearly specified and to have the tool in the water that we feel like can credibly count those fish.
Did you have a question, Senator?
Sure. Yeah, wait.
Well, let me just ask her a follow-up.
Sure.
Okay.
You're the boss.
Now you made me forget my question. Go ahead, Senator Bishop. I'll think of my question in a minute.
Sorry, man. I don't envy your job at all, especially when it comes to sonars and counting fish. So, if you were king for a day and you could buy any sonar on the planet, what would you buy and what would you implement? Is there a better product out there? Because these sonars, this isn't the first conversation we've had about sonars.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, at this point, the Didson sonar is the best technology that we're aware of for doing these kinds of counting projects. And it varies depending on the river you're talking about. How wide the river is, whether there's a lot of debris in the river. The challenges really vary depending on the river system that you're trying to assess, but we have a good level of confidence in the Didson for this particular application, and we also have an independent mark recapture program that we ran so that we would have a verification of king salmon abundance that's completely separate from the sonar, so that we would have that back check just knowing that sonar numbers can be somewhat of a challenge.
Thank you, ma'am.
Senator Faircloth, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I met with a constituent that was affected by some of the closures this past season, and I'm wondering what the process is for people that are affected by closures to get notification if those closures are coming on them fast. This particular crew outfit a boat, expended tens of thousands of dollars, only to find out within a 24, 48-hour period that the fishery was closed, and they couldn't return the products they'd purchased to stand up their boat to get ready to go out. So is there a process in place that if we know that we have a count that's coming in low, that we can notify people before they're investing other monies so that they don't get out on a, literally get out on a boat and not be able to recover any of their costs?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, we do forecast preseason in late winter, early spring, what we expect to see coming back to these rivers. And then we have a series of preseason meetings with users to try as best we can to get the word out if we expect to see low abundance, if we expect to see restrictions. And so we have been working on better communication preseason. But that being said, we don't always know preseason what we're going to see in season, and sometimes we do have to react quickly. We do the best we can when we make an announcement. For example, if we make an announcement for a restriction, we always try to include the abundance information that led us to that restriction and whether we believe that further restrictions or even a closure is possible in the future if that trend continues. So, and we have a number of different ways that we use to get that information out. You know, we have a wide range of folks and media outlets that are on our press release list. We use radio. We have recorded announcements so people can call the office and get the latest information. We update the web page quite regularly. So we recognize that that's an issue. And one of the things that I heard a lot this summer is that people would appreciate better predictability and better forecasting so that they can better plan their investments. And that's part of the impetus behind some of the work that we're proposing doing as in the Chinook Salmon Research Plan, is to improve our forecasting and our in-season assessments and our ability to give users the opportunity to plan whether they want to make investments in those fisheries or not.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd like to talk to you or one of your staff offline about this particular case and some at least backroom information about notification. I'm wondering if there's technology in place that people could sign up for an email list for a particular fishery so that they could be notified, and your support group is staffing that, saying that you do that. I'm not sure if this individual wasn't on it or not, but I'd like to get into more specifics for the particular constituent that that came to Anchorage to talk to me about that.
Absolutely. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thanks. I know a little bit about fish, a lot about them in Bristol Bay, where I fished for 25 years. And salmon, all it's all virtually a salmon fishery. And until the fish show back up near where we're counting them in a couple test fisheries out further out, you don't know what's coming back. The predictions are fine, but once the fish go to sea on high seas for 2-3 years, we don't know. This year, a lot less of them came back. Hundreds of thousands more of them showed up the Columbia River than anybody expected in northern Oregon. It's a crapshoot. But so they have the predictions. But in Bristol Bay, how many fish came in last year? Just a huge in Bristol Bay.
Yeah, tens of millions.
Tens of millions of them. And they can all go up the major river systems in three tides. And those times that they're going to go up can vary. I've seen as much as 2.5 weeks. You know, we always figure on the Quijack July 4th. That's only the mean. You know, and it's been a week late and a week early. And so it's a very, very dynamic situation. All of us who are in the business for a long time want the biological stock to be stable and even increase. So we all yell at these guys and so on, but we want them to do the very best. And if they have to put in an emergency stop to all of our fishermen, you got 1,800 or 2,000 permits out there, mostly with $300,000 invested. And we don't like sitting on the beach while the fish are going by, but they're doing the best they can in a very dynamic situation. And that's why you got to have emergency closures, you know, and you can't exactly predict when they're going to be. and it's just a very difficult situation. Similarly, when they reach their escapement, over-escapement can also be an issue, and so on and so forth, and they turn us all loose, you know, and we have combat fishing for 36 hours, you know, and very difficult. So I just think we've got to realize what a dynamic situation is. And they're doing pretty good, in spite of all our complaining.
Thank you for your comment, Senator Dyson. I sure agree, and yet at the same time, Setmetters live in my district. Senator Machicki?
Yeah, as you know, I represent north of the Kenai down past the Nanalchik, and you do have a very difficult job. A lot of weight on your shoulders. I'd expect your shoulders to be wider. I'm sure they are beneath it all, but my question is this, and we are well notified. I'm a commercial fisherman in Cook Inlet. I'm a drifter, and you do an excellent job. The problem is, in the last 10, we reached, including this year, the upper end of the escapement goal for Chinook. Learned about it too late to salvage a living for hundreds of families in my district and shared with and the Northern District as well. Do we have a plan? Are we working on a plan for a reaction time that does a better job in understanding what the later fish will be to maximize potential in harvesting other species?
Through the chair, Senator, you're correct. We really had a very late run of king salmon this year, unusually late, to the extent that our prediction around the middle of July was considerably lower than what the final number ended up being, because the question that a manager is always asking themselves when they have a low number at the 25th percentile of the run or when we have half the run in is it weak or is it late? Or is it both? And to what extent do we attribute this low number to low run strength versus late run timing? And that did result in the situation that we saw this year. So we're having a number of discussions with users through the Board of Fish process about the ability to have more of a step down situation when we see that. The management plan now is such a blunt tool. It's essentially either on or off. And if you're predicting, even if it's early in the season, and you don't have a lot of confidence in that prediction because it's so early, but if you're predicting to miss the lower end of that escapement goal, it is off according to the management plan. The In River fishery closes, the Eastside Set Net fishery closes, the Marine Water Sport fishery closes, and so we'd really like to have more flexibility when it's early in the season to be able to try to step people down, provide some opportunity while conserving Chinook until we get a better sense of what the run timing is. And that's what we're hoping to achieve through that task force process with the Board of Fish and with discussions with the users.
Good. We have about 5 or 6 minutes left for this half, so any... It goes fast.
Fortunately, I am coming close to the end. I just wanted to highlight a few things for you. I talked a little bit earlier about our work on state sovereignty and endangered species, and we've really increased our efforts in the past year or so to get more involved in research on species where we see a listing decision being made by a federal agency in the future. And so we want to be able to get into that process with some state science that's specifically targeted at the questions that those federal agencies are going to be asking about the status of the stock. And so we've received some additional funding, and we've targeted it at that type of research to do our best to prevent additional listings. But the reason that I have this listed as a challenge, despite the fact that Department of Law has had a couple of important victories lately on Endangered Species Act issues, the success on the polar bear critical habitat lawsuit is notable, and a partial victory that we had on a stellar sea lion lawsuit related to the NEPA process. I have this as a challenge because what we are seeing now is a trend we have not seen in the past, where federal agencies are listing species that are healthy, they're stable, they have good population numbers, and they're being listed solely on speculation about future climate change, often based on computer models. So the most recent decision by National Marine Fisheries Service to list some species of ice seal, where the population number is about 7 million, really illustrates for you the fact that if that is your logic, any species could be listed. If you can have a stable population that numbers in the millions, where the agency itself admits that there's no threat to the species in the next several decades, it really skews, we believe, the original purpose of the Endangered Species Act. And so we are struggling to respond to that type of listing because it is not about the science or the status of the stock. It's about climate models. And so we see this being a big issue for us going forward and something that we're going to have to continue to expend a lot of time and resources defending against.
Yes, Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that issue, are we joining with other coastal states that may be experiencing similar overstep into state issues for habitat and wildlife management?
Through the Chair, Senator Faircloth, yes, we are. We have a strong alliance through the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, which is essentially our contemporaries in the western states, and also there's a National Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. We work with both of those groups. The Attorney General has been quite active in getting the National Attorney General's group to take an interest in Endangered Species Act issues, and what we find is that as these climate listings proliferate, we are gaining more and more allies among states that are similarly affected.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Machuki.
Boy, this could have easily been the whole meeting.
Maybe, I know.
Maybe we can request maybe to have her back.
We need to have her back, yeah. I think we will be having her back anyway.
Quick question.
Fishery things. Go ahead.
Quick question, again, I mean, I live in a district that whose economy depends on healthy sport and commercial opportunities. But a third impact, which has gotten pretty incredible in the last decade or so, has been the dip-net fisheries, the mouth of the Kenai, the mouth of the Kasilof. I have one quick question for you. I know you're running short on time. Do you feel you have adequate staff to enforce and manage those two fisheries to your and your department's satisfaction?
Through the Chair, Senator Machuki, we have our area staff down there at times monitoring what's happening in that fishery. The Alaska Wildlife Troopers are the primary ones responsible for enforcement of the regulations in that fishery. And I think that certainly the troopers have to prioritize their resources based on everything that's going on, but certainly from my point of view, there would be a benefit to an additional presence when that fishery is going on. That fishery has grown dramatically, and so, you know, in my opinion, and I believe in the opinion of the city and some folks out in the peninsula, there would be a benefit to more resources.
Yes, Senator French.
I'll just say to that point, as a participant in that fishery, I found both the wildlife trooper and the city police presence to be fairly strong. There were a lot of people enjoying the fishery, but people were checking tickets, people were counting fish, people were making sure the rules were not being broken, at least when I was there.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll just move quickly through these last issues. I noted invasive species. That's something that that we've been working on, whether it's the invasive tunicate that was found in Whiting Harbor or invasive pike that we see in South Central lakes and rivers that we're attempting to eradicate. The department is putting efforts towards eradicating invasive species when they're found, but also focusing attention on the prevention and education aspects of this program. Our program is housed within Division of Sportfish. And then I wanted to note for you that one of the things that we see a pressing need for is modernization of our licensing system. We sell about 700,000 licenses a year. It's primarily a paper system, both at the consumer end, so you're filling out a paper form when you're buying a license, but also the reporting that we get from our vendors is all paper reporting, and it's labor intensive, and it's not providing the level of service that many of our customers want. Many people would like to be able to do online reporting for their personal use harvest instead of mailing in a postcard. Many of our sport fish guides would like to have electronic logbooks. So that's one of the things that we're hoping to take on, and we do have an item in the capital budget that would allow us to bring that program into modern times if we receive some funding to do so. So that is all I had for you.
Well, Commissioner, thank you very much. And we will be having you back. I'm pretty certain there'll be some additional discussion about fisheries issues, certainly on the Kenai as well as the Matsu Valley. But we'll talk more about that another time. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
All right, our next presentation is from the Department of Environmental Conservation, and I will invite Commissioner Larry Hartig to the table. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's good to be back. I feel like I always get the late afternoon or evening slot.
We're a late afternoon evening meeting, so...
Well, while we get the PowerPoint going, I'll introduce myself. Larry Hartig, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Mark Carlson Van Dort, our legislative liaison, is sitting here working the technology with me.
Clumsily.
And we're fortunate today in the audience that we happen to have our Deputy Commissioner, Lynn Kent, and all our division directors in Juneau at one time, which is a rarity. But Alice Edwards, our Air Quality Director, Tom Cherion, Department of or Division of Administration, Elaine Bussey Floyd, Environmental Health, Larry Dietrich, Spill Prevention and Response, and Michelle Hale in the Water Division. So, if we're ready, I have more slides than I probably should, so I'm going to move through these quickly, but if I'm going too fast on anything...
Oh, we'll break
you. Let me know. Thank you. DEC's mission, simply stated, is to protect human health and the environment. We see a direct linkage between those two things, that our health is dependent on a healthy environment, whether it's the air we breathe, or the water we drink, the food we eat, how we handle waste products and sanitation, how we respond to spills. And that's how we measure our success as a department. You know, how are we doing in providing those, what I see, core services to the public, you know, clean air, clean water, healthy food, et cetera. And when we make a decision in the department, you know, I usually start at a high level and work down in my thinking, and I think, well, what impacts would this have on human health? What impacts would this have on the environment we depend on? And then start sorting out the details. But that's our frame of reference as a department. We have five divisions, and just like Fish and Game, who you just heard from, we have an administration department that provides the IT, human resources, grant administration, loan administration, those kind of things, and we'll talk about some of those programs shortly, and they provide those services through the rest of the department. The other ones that we have are environmental health, air quality, spill prevention response, and water, and I'll be talking about each of these in alphabetical order and talking about some of their key programs and key challenges. Starting with the Division of Air Quality, this is our smallest division. Again, they're responsible for maintaining the healthy air that we breathe. And the way we do that as a department, and this is true of air quality, is we typically set standards, you know, what the quality of the air has to be, what pollutants or what levels of pollutants, you know, can be tolerated before it starts impacting human health and the environment. And then we take those standards, incorporate those into permits and authorizations that we would issue that set limits for various activities. And then we monitor for both compliance and monitor for effectiveness to make sure it's working and that people are complying with these requirements. And then if they aren't, then we would have typically compliance assistance where we'd work with them to bring them into compliance. And if that isn't working, we are a regulatory agency. We have enforcement powers and we can exercise those. But that's usually the way we proceed. And some of the the programs that we have in air quality is we have an air permits program, and there's three types of permits we issue. Two of those are under delegation from the federal government, from EPA, under the Clean Air Act. And those are pre-construction or construction permits. If you're going to build a large facility, it needs certain review and certain conditions put on it before it's even start construction to comply with the Clean Air Act. And then we have operating permits that once the facility is built, then these are, again, permits that arise under the Federal Clean Air Act that pull all the conditions for on air quality into one permit. And those are called operating permits, and those are renewed every 5 years. And then we have what was originally a state-based program and then now picks up some federal requirements, and those are called minor permits that we issue for smaller facilities, again, that control air emissions. We also monitor for compliance with those. And then we also have two other programs that I don't have a slide that I'll quickly mention, is a non-point source program, things that don't come out of stacks that we watch over and regulate, such as road dust we'll talk about in a minute. And then we also do monitoring just to check on conditions in various communities and report them on that. So challenges. The big one that you probably hear about most is Fairbanks fine particulate matter. This is really fine material that's produced primarily by the combustion of hydrocarbons, whether it's wood or coal or fuel oil. And it gets up into the air, and there's small particles that get deep into the body, into the lungs, and cause health adverse health effects. And Fairbanks has exceeded the human health level that's set nationally for these fine particulate. So now we're required under federal law to work with them in putting together an attainment plan on how they're going to come back in attainment with those health-based standards. And that's what we're working on with that community. It's challenging because right now people are wanting to switch to wood and to some degree coal because those are less expensive fuels to heat their homes and in some cases provide electricity, but those produce higher levels of particulate matter. And so it's that back and forth of trying to deal with the health impacts that we're responsible for, but at the same time try to provide the maximum flexibility of the community to meet their energy needs. The ultimate solution may be gas.
Yes, Senator French, question?
Actually, I'll defer to Senator Bishop and let him ask the question. It's on that topic, but...
Senator Bishop.
Ma'am, thank you, Senator French. Commissioner, third bullet, Clean Air Act has serious consequences if failed to plan or implement a plan. What are they?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, there's two primary hammers that EPA has. One is that they can withhold federal highway funds, which I think is about $11 million for the area. And they would usually do it by area versus by state, but they have that authority too. So that would be one way, and the other would be then put restrictions on new projects, federally permitted or federally authorized funded projects, where you would need a 2-to-1 trade-off before you could put that project in. You would have to, if it had X amount of PM2.5 emissions, you'd have to have 2X reductions before you could put it in. So in Fairbanks area, I could see that could really impact future development, like a gas line project or something like that. That could limit development up there, or base expansions would be a big concern.
Yes, ma'am, thank you. And did I hear you say that gas would help us lessen the PM2.5 problem?
That's correct, Senator, through the chair, is that it has less of an impact in terms of PM2.5. The challenges there that I see is to get gas even in there with state subsidies that, you know, could be possible. You still have to get people to switch, which would mean that gas would have to be relatively affordable compared to wood and coal to incentivize that switch.
And I think that's everyone's goal. Thank you.
Commissioner Hartig, how about wood pellets? Are they less of a particulate matter producer than regular wood?
Chairman Giesel, generally yes, although you can have very clean burning wood stoves and actually very clean burning coal stoves. So it really depends on the unit. There are new technologies, though, that I wouldn't just assume that one fuel versus the other is going to be cleaner, other perhaps gas. But among coal, pellets, and wood, it somewhat depended on the actual unit.
Thank you. Other questions, committee members? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Fairclough and I represent an area that has sometimes exceeded federal standards just because of glacial dust. Mm-hmm. And just comment on that, please.
Now, Senator Dyson, through the chair, it's not as quite a fine material. It's probably what we call PM10, and the difference is it's 10 micron versus 2.5 microns. It still has health impacts, but not as severe as the finer particles. And there are standards that are set for PM2.10. But when EPA looks at whether an area is in attainment or not in terms of the human health standards, they exclude natural events. For instance, forest fires, which generate a lot of PM2.5, but those are excluded and determine whether you have a non-attainment area.
Yes, Senator Fairclough.
Thank you. Following on that, and having had a recent trip to Fairbanks and experienced minus 52 on a different trip, but minus 40 on this one, how does the federal government view the inversion that's topographically appearing there that's holding in the particulate matter? Truly, are we having more emissions, or are they just being held in place by the weather system, which isn't in their control?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, you're exactly right, is that Fairbanks is a special situation. In my discussions with EPA, they are very understanding of that situation and trying to provide as much flexibility as they can. But kind of going back to my original point, we're a human health-related agency, and so that's what our driving goal is here, is protecting human health and trying to accommodate all the other needs. But the fact that there's an inversion, if there's the emissions are impacting human health, we got to deal with that. And so, we are getting a lot of recognition and flexibility from EPA on an understanding on that.
Madam Chairman, if I might.
Yes, Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I totally concur on the human health aspect. The issue for Fairbanks is that the stick may be coming at them, and they don't have a lot of choice because they have families that have invested, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, they've chosen to live there. The weather is happening around them. So I know that there's a balance there, and they understand those emission issues, and we have some people who are moving because of that and others that are continuing to struggle because it's homestead property or that they've built their lives there. So I know that you're advocating, and I support that, advocating for human health. I just feel for the families that are currently being burdened with this situation. Thank you.
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, when I look at Fairbanks, I see two related issues. One is overall coming into compliance with the 2.5 human health-based standards. So as a community, they have healthy air. And on that, there are certain tools that we can use, like better burning devices, whether it's wood, coal, pellet stoves, and trying to incentivize that. There's things like burning dry wood versus wet wood, and we're trying real hard on that. There's a lot of things that we believe, if we pursue, even with before you get to natural gas, that would have significant improvements in air quality. It would still allow people, you know, to live the life they want up there. The other thing that we're dealing with is more at the neighborhood level, you know, where there may be a problem boiler, there may be some particular problem that is health and nuisance related. And so that's a bit of a challenge for us as an agency, because you can imagine being in Juneau and getting a call about your problem with your neighbor's boiler. You know, it's hard for us to react and be nimble on those kind of things when local government, you know, can't fulfill that role. And that's typical around the state. I don't mean to pick on any particular community on that, but we're trying to address those issues too as we try to address the broader community air quality issue.
Senator Bishop had another pardon me. Senator Fairclough, did you have follow-up?
I do. Just two things real quickly, and I can take it offline. I'm wondering if we have appropriately placed, or the federal government has appropriately placed, the testing stations for the particulate matter. I know that in Anchorage, sometimes where they've chosen, Ken collects the most data, particularly for the particulate matter, but not necessarily affects human health in the same way. So I'm wondering if they're appropriately positioned in the Fairbanks area to capture truly the human health issue. And I can take it offline, Madam Chair. And the second issue that is going to be critically important to this legislative body is that we are promoting two engineering buildings up in the Fairbanks area, and that campus is a coal gen operation. that's providing heat and electricity. And I was in a overview this morning with the university where they were estimating the cost to put in another one, and waiting for gas is risky for them to do. And so you don't have to tell me today, but I'd like an assessment on the likelihood of a coal generation plant license being issued if they have a PM2.5 violation that hasn't been resolved. And I'll take that later if that's possible.
Senator Bishop?
Briefly, we could spend the rest of the, and I'm sorry, ma'am, but I just want to do a quick follow-up. Commissioner, maybe we need to get you in Fairbanks here, maybe after the session's over, sit down and have a good, thorough vetting of this and on this PM2.5 going forward, because I just come back to the feds excluding PM2.5 from forest fires, because we're going to be coming into spring again, and some of those fires across the flats are going to be kicking up, and when that wind comes into Fairbanks, you know, it could there you go, bust the quality, air quality for a day. And it's real. I mean, PM2.5 is PM2.5, you know, so particulates are particulates. And I just think the feds need to take that into consideration.
Senator Machicki?
Commissioner, I find it fascinating and counterproductive that the EPA will restrict federal highway funds and project funds from a community that's struggling with economic choices for fueling, heating their homes, generating electricity. It seems that they should be contributing funds to help. And this is just a stretch of a concept, but when families are using every available dollar to heat their homes, they're certainly not contributing with the best nutrition for their families and other choices that also affect human health. Is there a program, an EPA program, that could help with reducing PM2.5 in a community that has limited choices for fuel sources?
You know, Senator Machicki, through the chair, as far as the tool that U.S. Congress gave EPA on this, you know, I have my own personal opinions on that too, but I don't think I can do much about that. But I would note that I do truly believe that EPA is really trying to work with the state in Fairbanks and recognizes as a unique situation with the inversions, the fuel costs, and on and on. I don't think they're going to be using that hammer liberally or quickly or anything like that. And there is a policy under EPA that as long as you're making reasonable progress towards achieving attainment and you just need more time, that they can do that. Now, that you might have outside critics that will try to push them quicker, because there are people in Fairbanks that don't want to tolerate this situation because they feel like they're being impacted. So there's two sides to that. But EPA, I would say at this point, I would be surprised if they would do anything that would be rash. Or I think we, as long as we continue to try hard to make reasonable progress and are getting there, I wouldn't expect those sanctions. I'd certainly be arguing very hard against them.
And yet, Commissioner, the air quality in Fairbanks was cited as justification for the emission control area that's being instituted 200 miles along the coast of the North American continent. For ships.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, Madam Chair. I wasn't aware, though, that there was a connection there that EPA had.
That was one of the justifications that was cited. They began with the lichen on Mount Roberts affecting the health of the caribou that are here in Juneau. And when they discovered there were no caribou here, they said, oh, it's the air quality in Fairbanks that's a factor.
I wasn't part of that one.
I'll let you proceed. It doesn't look like there's any questions or comments, though. Perhaps they're unspoken comments.
That was obviously a big challenge that we got there, but we are working very closely with the community and everyone else. On The other thing that we're doing, and I know all the other resource departments are doing this in Fish and Game Engine, is what we call permit reform. And what I mean by permit reform is look for efficiencies and get our priorities right. And talking about efficiencies, it means not just for the department, it also means for the public. And if we're doing something now that maybe we don't need to do or isn't a priority, let's quit doing it and move on to something else, because it's a burden to us and it's a burden to the public. But I'll give some examples here in a minute. I won't dwell on this slide. Going back to air quality issues, rural dust is another issue in rural communities, particularly July. There'd be a lot of dust stirred up. And so we're working collaboratively with a number of communities and DOT on measures that can be done to try to keep the dust down, again, for health reasons in the community. Another thing that we actively work on, and I think we kind of alluded to this already, is there's a lot of aggressive moves by the federal government to adopt new standards, and a lot of them are air standards, and there's perhaps needs for it in parts of the country, but they don't always fit well in Alaska. And yeah, so we do have situations like rural dust, or we have things like PM2.5 in Fairbanks. We have to have lead in our aviation gas. We can't switch out fuels in villages too easily because there's only one tank and it's got to serve all different sorts of people, so we might not be able to have ultra low sulfur diesel as quick as in all those communities you might elsewhere in the country. These kind of things, that's a big part of what our air quality division, what our department does as a whole. As I see, we're kind of a back and forth between EPA and the Alaska public to try to kind of rationalize the rulemaking and then its implementation, and I give you lots of examples of that one. Next division, environmental health. It's a bit of a grab bag of a division. They do a number of different things that are listed here. It's food safety, it's drinking water systems, public water systems, which are basically 15 people or more. It's solid waste management, that's landfills primarily around the state. Talk about those in a minute. The drinking water program, this is again, a federal act delegated to the state, Safe Drinking Water Act. You'll hear about drinking water rules. You've probably heard about them over the years in this body. And what EPA does is, again, adopts national rules that apply to all public drinking water systems in the country, and then we're required to implement those. And we do get about $11 million or so a year in grant funds from EPA for drinking water systems around the state. But what we get from EPA isn't directly relevant or directly related to new rules. So it isn't like we get a new rule, we get more money. So we're always kind of struggling to keep up with these new rules. And it's a particularly struggle for rural communities because sometimes these are pretty complex and difficult to implement and understand. And so a big piece of what we do is working with the rural communities and trying to upgrade their systems or adapt to these new rules. That's a little bit about the program. Just again, talking primarily about the outreach in rural communities.
Could I ask a question about the drinking water? Do you manage the Village Safe Water Program?
Right. And we'll get that. It's in our water division.
Okay.
In the facilities program, and I'll get to that in just a
okay,
few
great.
Minutes.
Thank you.
One of the other things that we control are we manage the pesticide program in the state. And if it's we restrict application of pesticides to certain lands and to water and aerial applications, those all need permits. But one of the things that we're seeing is particularly with the concerns about invasive species, which Commissioner Campbell referred to, is I think there'll be more and more pressure to use pesticides. And they've been a bit disfavored in Alaska. I think Alaska is one of the states that is probably most conservative, and I certainly am not a huge pesticide fan. But I think we're going to be more and more pressure for pesticide use just because of invasive species as one tool to try to deal with them. So that's one of the challenges that I see going forward. And going back to what I mentioned in passing about permit reform in terms of efficiency and prioritization, pesticides have to be approved by EPA, and again, that's where the science happens. There's rigorous studies, and before you can register and use a pesticide, you also have to register their use in Alaska with DEC before you can use one in the state or sell one in the state. But once they're registered, the science should be done, and as long as they're being applied in compliance with all the federal requirements which the state adopts, we shouldn't have to issue the same permit each time and go through the same debate each time. And I'd rather put my money towards actually being out there in the field, making sure they do what they're supposed to do. So I've been trying, at least with the state agencies, moving away from having issue a lot of permits and going to state agencies required to have integrated pest management plans where they try to look at alternatives to pesticides. If they use pesticides, how they're going to train their people and oversee their people and how they're going to apply it safely, and use the money we save from writing more and more permits to being doing more inspections. And so we're just changing our regs now to accomplish that. This will be the first summer where we're going to do that, and hopefully it'll help the railroad, it'll help DNR with Plant Material Center, but it'll also allow us to work with them on kind of a better game plan on the use of pesticides and the oversight of those.
Could I ask you a question? You're talking about pesticides, but you also mean herbicides, am I correct?
Pesticides is a broader category that would include herbicides.
Thank you.
Solid waste, these are the landfills. The big landfills, 5 tons or more a day, like the municipality of Anchorage, those are all permitted and regulated pretty well. When you get to the rural areas, it's a little more challenging to them and to us. So what we're trying to do is move towards more of best management practices rather than having them spend a lot of time trying to comply with permits and us issuing permits and charging a permit fee, working more closely with those communities on just best management practices that they can implement to lessen the potential impacts of their landfills. Keep going, that's about that. Food safety and sanitation, that's something else we do is we food produced and consumed in the state. We have that, and then if it's being shipped outside the state, then the federal government would have that. But as far as food inspections, they contract often with DEC to do their inspections for them, and we actually work off of that to do our state inspections in some of the rural communities.
Commissioner, Senator Bishop had a question.
I'd like to get time offline. I'd like to talk to you about that food safety one for a minute with a local fish processor. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, one of the challenges that we have in most states, maybe all of them except Alaska, I don't know, the food inspections would be due at a county level, you know, like restaurants, hospitals, daycares, schools, that sort of thing. But in Alaska, the municipality of Anchorage is the only one that has their own food inspection program, and so we end up doing it all over the state, and that's, of course, a big challenge for us. The state veterinarian is located in DEC. Has a number of responsibilities, but some of that people, I'm sure Senator Giesel realizes this, but a lot of human diseases arise in animal populations, and so it's important that our human health lab, you know, track animal diseases in the state, the health of the animal populations, and then our lab is located directly next to the human health lab. So if you have things like bird flu that we work on collaboratively, you know, we might take the samples in and analyze them and provide them to them for kind of the analysis of potential human health impacts. Another thing that we do is surveillance of various contaminants in fish in the state. We'll get fish tissue samples from Fish and Game. We'll analyze it at the Human Health Lab for mercury and other potential contaminants that could be coming from China or other places in the world. And we are seeing those. We're seeing increase in levels of mercury, for instance. And then we report those to Health and Social Service, and then they do an assessment of what that means in terms of potential impacts to subsistence or other users in Alaska. So it's important that we monitor, and that's where we do it. And again, we have the Human Health Lab. The other thing that's new to us is the Japanese tsunami marine debris. The governor executed an executive order last summer that put DEC in the lead in terms of response and coordination for the state on Japanese marine debris. And it's been a very active area for our Environmental Health Department. They just got finished last week meeting with the federal and state agencies and putting together the plan for next summer. Well, it's not finished yet, but we plan to roll it out during the Forum on the Environment next week. But it's really good collaboration with NOAA. It's going really well, and with the other federal and state agencies involved in this. And but it's a real challenge for the state because we are anticipated to get, and already have got, the bulk of the debris that's going to reach the western U.S.
And just a question on that, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator French.
Which part of the state has been impacted the most severely by that, if you can say?
Well, Senator French, through the chair, you're probably familiar that we have something we call collector beaches in Alaska that get the bulk of the marine debris even before the tsunami, and those are the beaches that are still getting it. In Prince William Sound, like Montague Island is getting hit really hard, Kayak Beach, Kayak Island, Hinchinbrook Island. Prince William Sound, I think, is probably getting hit the hardest. Core Point, the point on the Kenai Peninsula going towards Kodiak, is probably getting a fair amount too. Less so in southeast Alaska. We're really not seeing that much or hardly any out in the chain.
And just to follow up, what do you see happening? I mean, is there going to be, are we going to bulldoze that stuff and clean it up? Are we going to wait for the tides to carry it away? What's going to happen?
Senator Finch, the chair, there's two things that, or at least two things that would drive that. Again, kind of the priority based on what the impact would be to the environment. What we're primarily seeing now is styrofoam, polystyrene type material, whether it's fishing floats or construction material. And that does break down in the surf and tides into smaller pieces. And so the big concern is it would probably be like the plastics that could be ingested by birds, mammals, other marine life, and then either cause them to quit eating because they feel full or start actually plugging up their system, you know, like plastics do. And we've been talking with NOAA about getting better research on that, and they're certainly aware that's the bulk of the type of debris we're seeing right now. But that was this last season, and you would expect that what we call the higher windage items, those things that float higher in the water and more wind-driven, would show up first. So it doesn't necessarily indicate what we might get next season and the season after that. But right now, that's primarily what we're seeing is that material. So we're evaluating how much of that we need to remove, but it's difficult because it's bulky, even though it's light, and you can't really burn it too well because you get acid gas and other things that are not good for human health. So it is a issue about how you get this bulky material and how you get it out of this when it's getting broken down in the surf and remove it. And so it's a question of money and how much effort you want to put into it, particularly these remote areas that we're talking about. So it's a balance that's being worked out among the agencies, and it kind of depends on what happens in terms of federal funds and what other resources we might get.
Sounds like you're still deciding. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, we're still working on that plan, but certainly that'll be public, and we'll be rolling that out very shortly.
Sure. We have about 15 minutes left. Senator Dyson has a question.
Yeah, Commissioner, I would encourage you all to look at privatizing that and have the receiving barges stationed around somewhere and let all the commercial fishermen aren't working and recreational boaters and stuff and go pick stuff up, compress it and weigh it, or go by volume or something, but mobilize an army of hundreds to go out and do it, because government's just not equipped to do that sort of stuff.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that's exactly what we're doing. It's all being contracted out. Those aren't DEC people out there. The only time that we would probably have somebody out there is if they encounter something that might be hazardous, you know, hazardous waste material. There are several contractors that have been out there, some for 10 years or more, like Gulf of Alaska Keeper. And they have been operating, again, just marine debris is nothing new, as you know. It's not just from the tsunami. But these people are experienced in going out there, and these are remote beaches, so we don't want to send people out there that don't have the wherewithal to, with the bears and the surf and everything else that you got to deal with out there. But these people are part of that planning group, too, the people that have been out there for the last 10 years doing this and helping us figure that out, and also the logistics of how to kind of stage the collection areas and the timing. And so there's a lot of good people working on it, but it is it'll be contracted out.
Yeah, I appreciate the answer, and that is a very reasonable, low-risk way to do it. But I would hope that those guys, you know, would be able to employ lots of local folks. And, I think there's a limited role for protecting people from their own stupidity. And there'd be some liability issues and so on. But you could turn an army loose out there, you know, and if they can make $200 or $300 a day or so, lots of them would be very glad to do that, particularly in the off season.
Well, it'll take those kind of resources.
I'll let you go ahead and proceed.
Okay, so we go on to the next department, and that's spill prevention and response. The way I think of this division is somewhat in order of things, that First, you try to prevent a spill. That's our industry preparedness and pipeline operations, preventing spills kind of at an industry level. Then you have our PERT program, Prevention Emergency Response, and they're also involved a bit in prevention. We'll talk about that in a minute. But they're also the SWAT crew. If there's something spills or is about to spill, they're the ones that are out there with the contractors dealing with it. And then once that emergency situation is taken care of, if there's still contamination out there that needs to be cleaned up or monitored over time, that would be the Contaminated Sites program. That would be kind of looking at the longer-term issues. The last program is the Response Fund Administration people, and we'll talk about the Response Fund in just a minute. Just quickly, just to kind of give you some background on spills, the total number of spills, both land and water, is gradually creeping down. I'd say it's been around 1,500 to 2,000, maybe going more towards the 1,700 range. That's new spills a year and reported. I'm not necessarily there might be more. I'm just saying this is reported to us. Next slide.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
Just a quick one. Just do we have a program within DEC? I mean, prevention science and best practices in certain industries have reduced spills dramatically. Do we have a program within DEC to help train those handling fluids on some of those best practices to reduce those incidents?
Senator Machicki, to the chair, we, depending on the facility that we're talking about, they may be required to have a spill plan that would have prevention measures included in that. So they would have to describe for us what that training would be and the oversight and what best management practice they have in place to prevent spills. And then certainly we look at then training and testing people on that, drills and that sort of thing. So I think that the short answer is yes. But I don't know exactly what you envision as a program, but we certainly put a heavy emphasis on prevention because prevention is a lot easier than response.
I mean, if I may, just
yes.
The prevention science and programs I'm talking about are primarily industrial. And a lot of your reportable spills are in smaller operators or even independents. Right. And it would be helpful for some of those that don't handle as many fluids to learn about some of that, some of those practices. So that's essentially
a good point. And that's actually a point that comes up in these next couple of slides. The one that you're looking right now, this would be looking at 2012. If you're looking at the volume that was released in the environment of reported spills, you can see the great volume is diesel. And that would be fuel tanks around the state. And then so at aviation fuel, gasoline, overfills, leaks, that sort of thing, that's exactly what you're talking about. And if you were looking at kind of the big industrial people like crude oil, that isn't on this slide, but if you're going to look at the total volume for 2012, that would be around 10%, maybe something in that range. You know, so it's a small percentage, you know, the volume of spills in the state. Most of them would be exactly what you're talking about. Next slide.
Yes, Senator Fairclough has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you may be getting to it, but I'm wondering what the definition of a spill is. So we see that there is a magnitude listed, but we don't know how much, or I don't know how much it is yet. So can you define what a spill is that qualifies for the numbers on slide 22?
It would be a spill into the environment versus a release into, like, another containment area or something like that. It would be something good into the environment.
I was talking quantity. Is there how do you define a spill?
In terms of quantity? Excuse me. Yeah.
Well, how do you define it, period? But I'm wondering if there's a quantity. I'm looking at, it says 72%. I don't know what that's relevant to. Is it a tablespoon or is it gallons? Or?
Yeah, I'd have to.
And if for each event would, I'm sorry, each event would certainly be unique to the volume out. I just was wondering if we have a definition that qualifies for one, a spill.
Through the chair, I can get you that if there's a minimum volume in the range, because it would really vary from year to year. You know, that you see just in the total spills, you could have one big spill that would comprise a lot of it. So you'd have to look at it, I think, over time and just see if there's a pattern there. The pattern is it's going down. The pattern would be, too, that the bulk of the spills would be diesel. I don't think 2012 data that you see up there is misrepresentative of that. This would be, I think, consistent with the trend, what you're seeing there. I believe that Senator Machiki's observation that a bulk of it would be smaller spills with a few big bumps in there for particular releases would be accurate, too. This slide just shows the ownership. This is historical, looking back about 17 years. And the pie chart on the right shows about historically half the spills are on federal-owned property, federal-managed properties, whether military or federal civilian. Those would be other agencies like FAA, for instance, and then 33% private, and then local government and state. This just shows some of the responsibilities of the Spill Emergency Response Division. They also have... They do the drills and exercises. They do the government plans on how we prepare ourselves for response regionally. You want to go to the next slide. One of the things they do is work with local communities, and something we've been putting a lot of emphasis in is working with local governments, local tribes, to go out there and train people up on to be first responders and to put connexes of equipment in these communities so that it's readily available in the event of a spill. But most of them are these small spills, so this provides them a way of getting at and responding to those quickly. The other advantage it has, if we have big spills, then we have people that trained up and know how we work and respond to spills, and we can bring in that local knowledge, that local talent to help us deal with a larger spill that sometimes occurs. Some of the challenges, there's shipping, marine transportation is one area that we're looking at very closely and been doing a lot of work in. And it's really breaks down regionally around the state, and you have to look at the different regions differently. You have the goods going between North America and Asia and the Great Circle Route, and that's increasing with the bitumen and coal coming from Canada and Montana and all and through those northwest ports to Asia. And that all that traffic goes through the Aleutians or next to the Aleutians, and so that's the risk for us there. And we have seen drift groundings in that area, the Selendang IU, remember that, the soybeans, and then there was the Golden Seas, which was a near miss about 2 years ago, another bulk carrier that lost power out there. To the right of that is kind of related to the Aleutians is the kind of the Arctic areas. And you can't see it too well on this slide, but those two arrows are going through Bering Strait. But whether you're on the Northern Sea Route, there's 46 ships this last season in passage that went that route, or the northern part of Russia, you know, bringing fuel and other LNG this year and other products down there, it's all going through Bering Straits. And anything going up and to the Northwest Passage, even if it doesn't go all the way to eastern Canada, this goes up there regionally, like to the Beaufort or Chukchi for drilling, is all going through the Bering Straits. So, you know, something we have to deal with. It presents a lot of the same weather challenges as the Aleutian. Southeast Alaska in the left corner might be the most scary because there you have passengers in pretty confined areas, large cruise ships. You think of the Concordia and what happened over in Europe and those kind of situations where you could have passengers and fuel in the water at the same time. And to the right of that is Cook Inlet area that has a lot of the similarities actually in the Arctic where you have ice-infested waters. But you also have big tides, volcanoes, you have oil rigs out there, you have the big salmon fishery and the largest community in Alaska there with traffic going back and forth to that. So different challenges, different areas. We do have marine casualties around the state, as this picture demonstrates. Next slide. So we're looking at, well, what would be the components, and this is how we look at conceptually what we need to have in place. And it's, you think, well, what do you need if you have a marine disaster? We have to be able to recognize when there's a disaster, including on ships in innocent passage where they don't even speak English. How do you track those? How do you know when they're getting into problems? You have to have some vessel go out to them if they've lost power. You have to get a tow on them. You have to have somewhere to take them that is safe, both from the weather and that if there's a spill that's still occurring that won't impact valuable resources in the area. And eventually you have to get them somewhere where you can do repairs. And you think of the Kolik. You can think, yeah, recently you can see all these pieces. But that's what we have to have in place, and that's what we're working towards in the Aleutians and other areas. Next division, industry preparedness response. These are the ones, people that work with contingency plans we talked about a minute ago. If you have certain facilities that are handling fuel, storing fuel in the state, They have to have plans on how they're going to prevent spills and respond to spills. The state's unique. You have to have more than a plan. You have to have the resources identified on how you're going to implement that plan. That's something unique with Alaska. And we drill those plans. We make sure that people can actually perform them.
Just a question on that.
Yes, Senator French.
Thank you. Back in the, when the big Gulf spill happened, I think BP and some of the oversight agencies suffered some embarrassment when it turned out that their plan was just wildly, not wildly, but they had some sort of significant holes in it.
Predicting walruses.
Walruses is the thing that comes to mind, and I'm sure it comes to your mind as well. I guess I just have to ask, you know, have you or some of your staff gone through the oil spill contingency plans on file with DEC to a degree that makes you certain that we're not going to suffer the same kind of embarrassment if there's a major spill in Alaska?
Yeah, Senator French, through the chair, I certainly hope we don't have any of those kind of situations. The short answer is yes. I mean, we certainly looked at what happened in the Gulf as a lessons learned too, and see if there's anything there that we should be paying attention to here that and make ourselves better. In fact, Larry Dietrich, our SPAR director, participated on the Coast Guard national panel to review that incident, and it took a lot of his time to do that because he had to fly back and forth to the South 48. But I kind of looked at it as that as a way to get in there and really know what's going on in terms of reports and
excellent.
So forth, and brought that back to us. And I spent a fair amount of time with Fran Ulmer, and she did with our department, because she was on, of course, the President's Commission on that. So we took that event very seriously and didn't want to just say, oh, we know we got a good system. We wanted to learn as much as we could from that, too. But coming out of that, yes, we did learn things, but I think that our planning process is robust.
Thank you. Thank you.
Commissioner, we've reached 5 o'clock. And I'm aware that you're coming back to join us on Saturday for the introduction of some bills. I'm wondering if you would be willing to start on slide 31 at the beginning on Saturday, because we're in a significant part of your responsibility, and that being the spill issues, the water issues, wastewater, those kinds of things. Would that work for you?
That would certainly work for me, Madam Chair, and whatever the committee desires, I'd be happy to do that.
If you could do that on Saturday, we could finish up with this overview on Saturday at the beginning of our meeting and then proceed into the review of the bills.
We'll do that.
All right, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is 5 o'clock. I will remind members of the committee that on Friday, February 1st, we're going to have a meeting. Our meeting will be talking about the fundamentals of the oil patch with Bill Barron, Director of Oil and Gas, who will be walking us through petroleum leasing and unitization issues. And then on Saturday, we'll be meeting to conclude the commissioner's presentation and also hearing Senate Bill 26 and 27. Those packets for bills, Senate Bill 26 and 27, have already been delivered electronically to your offices and are posted on BASIS for public access. So with that, we'll adjourn this meeting. The time is 5:01 p.m.